This is the Big E Sports Show
on the Sports Map Radio Network.
From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Elissa Walker Campbell.
Hey, welcome back, Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. I am Elissa Walker Campbell, and indeed, it is a very big weekend in the world of golf. The 2023 Masters, it is underway, always brings a myriad of storylines. But right now, we're going to focus our attention on the upcoming NFL draft that is set to get underway later this month, in fact, April 27th. We're also going to highlight on how things turned out at this year's Combine. And my guy, he is back. That is Andy McNamara, National Fantasy Sports host with UFF Sports and Topham Sports. How are you, Andy?
I'm doing well, Lisa. How are you?
Always excited to have you on the program. You bring great perspective and insight. And the Combine, it's in the books. Hundreds of prospects took to Indianapolis last month with the hopes of improving their draft stock. And we wanted you to weigh in on what does this mean for the upcoming draft here on the 27th?
Well, I think what it means is really the biggest takeaway out of it, and it was probably Bryce Young, and it was in part because, okay, he'd throw and all that. Quarterbacks have done that before, so, you know, whatever. But the official measurements, that's what I think people overlook. And sometimes that can make a big difference because he came in, you know, 5'10", kind of, you know, 204. Okay, you know, there's words that's probably a bit heavy. You know, probably drink a lot of water before that or something. So, you know, drink a couple bottles, that's fine. But the thing is, you have to look at it, because coming into the Combine, it was, okay, Bryce Young, probably first overall pick, C.J. Stroud right there. Well, coming out of the Combine, we saw C.J. Stroud in person. We saw the measurables. We saw he looks like that. That's what a first overall pick looks like. 6'3", 200-plus, can move, just look gorgeous, his technique and footwork. I always watch the footwork in those drills for quarterbacks. How smooth is the drop back? Because a lot of them play out of shotgun, right? So how smooth is the drop back? You look at the feet, do they plant, do they push? Against air, no pressure, of course. You know, you should look good, but a lot of guys don't. So when I look at that coming out of it, I think Bryce Young was the biggest loser, because I would be shocked if he went first overall. Because, Elissa, I know people say, oh, the intangibles. And the bottom line is he's 5'10", and the only guy who's done it at that height, and he's a bit bigger, is Russell Wilson, of any note. You know, say Drew Brees. Well, Drew Brees is 6 feet. 2 inches can make a difference in the height when you have to look over. And you have to have everything right. But even our guy, Baker Mayfield. Right, Baker, shade under 6'1". And everything had to be right. You have to move in the pocket. You have to make sure you get those lanes to be able to see downfield. Well, C.J. Stroud just looks over the line. It doesn't matter. Bryce Young, you have to have everything perfect for him. And I'm not saying he's going to be a day one bust. I think, actually, at the start of his NFL career, he'll probably be the best starter maybe for the first half of the season until teams catch up with him, and inevitably he gets squashed by those giant linemen that we also saw at the Combine.
Yeah. Hey, National Fantasy Sports host with Topham Sports, UFF Sports as well, is Andy McNamara. Give him a follow on Twitter, at AndyMC. And so what I hear you saying, when we talk about Bryce Young, he's risky. He's a risky bet because of his size.
Yeah.
Yes?
Yeah, 100%. Everything, okay, Colt McCoy when he got out of college, was the most prolific passer in college football history. And he's made a heck of a career out of a backup quarterback. Colt McCoy is a third-round pick of the Browns. That's fine. Now, you want to put Bryce Young, third-round pick, I love it. Now, he's going first round, of course, right? But if I'm looking at these quarterbacks, if I'm an NFL franchise and a GM, because quite often you only get one shot at these high picks. You get one shot, and if you're wrong, you're gone, and you're fired, and you end up somewhere else. So do I want to risk on a 5'10", 204? I don't care about the intangibles. A guy who's, you know, look at Kyler Murray, right? And I could argue Kyler Murray's more mobile. Bryce Young, better arm, I think, but you look at the size-wise, and if I'm going to miss as a GM, do I want to miss on a 5'10 guy, or do I want to miss on even a Will Levis, 6'4", 229? Look at the arm, right? Do I want to miss on Anthony Richardson? Bigger, stronger, faster than Cam Newton. Not as good. Guy can't read a defense yet to save his life. He's got to improve on that. But physically, do I want to fail on one of those guys and take a shot at maybe finding the next Josh Allen type? Josh Allen, remember, folks, super raw. He didn't go to Buffalo, but Josh Allen would be Mitch Trubisky right now. I'm guaranteeing it. So who do I want to take a chance on? So that's where I come down with Bryce Young. I think it's too risky, but, you know, they'll probably end up going to maybe the Texans at two. You know, maybe they feel they can get things in place for him.
So who will be the first quarterback taken in the 2023 NFL draft?
C.J. Stroud, no questions about it. No doubt in my mind. I think if it's not C.J. Stroud, whoever makes that decision will be an analyst on a network the next year. Because they'll be fired. Okay? That's why. If you're the Carolina Panthers and you don't take C.J. Stroud, you'll be fired because it's not going to work out for you. If you're the first overall pick, you can't miss. You can't miss. You have to hit it right. That is a franchise-defining and ruining situation if you're wrong. C.J. Stroud, like I said, 6'3", 215, over. And here's the other thing, too. We're not just talking about a guy because you can list stats all day, and we've seen great athletes at quarterback that don't do it. The thing that stands out to me with C.J. Stroud is he overcame adversity. And I'm a Buckeyes fan. He overcame adversity on the fly. When he first came in, first couple games C.J. Stroud played, everyone wanted him out.
Yeah.
Buckeye fans, he's not the guy. Okay, well, let's hold on. And then he developed, and he developed under the brightest lights. There's few programs with more eyes on them each week, more high-profile games than Ohio State. And so C.J. Stroud learned. He struggled. He overcame. He developed. He kept improving. And what I saw also is that footwork kept improving from what I saw at the combine as well. Clean footwork. Mobile, as we know. Could be more mobile. Like, that's a good thing. He's not doesn't look to run first, but he can. Awesome touch on the ball. Can make every throw, and the delivery is so smooth. Now, again, you get to the NFL. You know, you're up against defenses. They're tricking you. How does that all work? But from a technique and look-wise, no doubt in my mind, it should be C.J. Stroud.
You know, last time you were on the program, we were talking about the Bears were going to have the number one draft pick. Now it is the Panthers. And so, I mean, where do you see them going with this pick?
Yeah, Panthers, you just got to go quarterback. Now, the question and problem is, well, okay, so you take your quarterback, which makes sense. You know, they got new regime there and everything. But you also need weapons. And we saw the Chicago Bears really struggle with this when they took Justin Fields, right? And now they're going to be able to have those assets to build up and build around him, which I think Justin Fields is going to be in a sensational spot this year. Fantasy football scouts, make sure try to get some Justin Fields shares on your fantasy team. But when you look at the Panthers, okay, so you give up all the picks. Your quarterback, Adam Thielen, all right, we all know the name. But he's on the downside. He's going to be more of a possession guy, close to a catch and fall down guy. DJ Chark, nice piece on a good team. He's probably your third wide receiver, maybe pinches to a WR2. Terrence Marshall, nice talent. Again, should he really be a starting three wide receiver? No. Will he have the chance to improve? Possibly. You got Laviska Shenault, who's a gadget guy as well, maybe. Hayden Hurst, nice tight end. Like, you have a lot of. You have a lot of okay pieces. Miles Sanders is back there. You got a nice, reliable veteran running back to help you out. So you have some pieces, but not enough, you know? So that'll be interesting to me how they try to build around C.J. Stroud, assuming they take him, and build him up sooner than later. Because we know there's no patience in the world today. You don't get 5 years. You don't get to sit the guy. C.J., whoever they pick, that guy's playing opening day.
Okay, we've talked about C.J. Stroud, Bryce Young. What is your assessment of this year's quarterback class?
I like it. I do. I like Stroud. I like Young from a talent side, but I just don't, NFL-wise, long-term, no. He's just too small. The two most interesting ones to me are Will Levis and Anthony Richardson. Those are the two most interesting to me. And then you have some of the other. After you drop off from those four, then you really drop off. Like a Stetson Bennett from Georgia. Oh, what a college career. Phenomenal. Yeah. But I could see him. You know, he's kind of got more of that high-end career backup feel to him. Max Duggan, sort of the same thing out of TCU. But with Will Levis, I think Anthony Richardson, he's, from what I've picked up, now he is, again, super raw. Couldn't read a defense to save his life. But what you watch, and again, that's why people say, oh, the combine, they're just running around in their underwear. It doesn't matter. Watch. You got to watch these guys. Because Anthony Richardson, he missed a throw. He's not like, oh, well, I don't care. I got this figured out. He was mad at himself. So what does that tell you? That tells me this guy wants to learn. And he's developing. And he's trying really hard. And he's got all those tools. And with that physicality, as long as you can kind of give him a crash course and be able to read defenses to some degree year one, this guy can just run through people. He's not a thin, slight guy like a Kyler Murray, who, when he runs around, if a guy catches him, oof, it's going to get ugly. Anthony Richardson is going to run through you, and then he's going to keep going. So that's what's interesting. And the Will Levis out of Kentucky, the 6'4", 229. I was worried a bit about the footwork. Looked good in the combine, the big arm, the touch and placement of the ball, inconsistent. But he reminds me of Josh Allen-type raw ability, right? It reminds me of that because people forget again. Josh Allen, all over the place. Oh, what's this guy going to do? Landed in Buffalo. If he went to the Jets, if he went to my Browns, if he went to the Cardinals, who all drafted other quarterbacks, he'd be out. So Will Levis, where does he go? And if he does go to a right spot that nurtures him and can grow him, we could be seeing, he could be the talk of this draft class come a couple years.
Our NFL draft coverage continues with Andy McNamara after this quick break.
Working in the oil and gas industry requires that you have the best equipment available because every job counts. At Energy Well Fab, our goal is to manufacture the best oil and gas processing equipment for customers through hard work and commitment. We proudly stand behind quality products just as we have for over 30 years. From inside out, we promote excellence, precision, and dedication. These values are the foundation for our success and why we continue to progress and go unmatched in customer satisfaction, loyalty, and service. Contact Energy Well Fab for your oil and gas processing equipment needs at energywellfab.com.
Listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Elissa Walker Campbell.
Hey, good stuff. Andy McNamara with us a few more minutes at Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. Check him out. Give him a follow on Twitter at AndyMC81. He is the national fantasy sports host at Topham Sports and also at UFF Sports. You've talked about and highlighted Anthony Richardson, I should say. And certainly he had a historic performance at his pro day. What all did he show as far as just how special of a player he is?
He ended it with a cool flip. That was neat.
Okay.
Whenever players do that, I'm like, oh, dude, don't break your ankle or don't pull an Achilles or something.
Right.
Those pro days, that's why if I'm looking at a pro day versus a combine, I put more stock in the combine because you're throwing with and against systems and players and situations that you're not comfortable with, you don't know. If you don't have a good pro day, there's something really wrong because that is as heavily scripted as possible. So he came out of that looking great. You know, he moved well against, you know, no equipment, nothing. It was a very choreographed version of the combine. So no red flags to me came up out of there. Made some cool throws, showcased, got some oohs and ahs, the athleticism. I learned nothing new out of his pro day. I did learn a bit more out of his combine. I'm just really interested to see where he goes. Because if we look at this draft class, okay, mm-hmm. So Carolina, Houston, 1-2, they're going quarterback, right? Cardinals, I don't think will go quarterback. Colts very well could. Is that where we see a Will Levis or Anthony Richardson? What would be really interesting, if the Texans, let's say for argument's sake, Panthers go Stroud, Texans go Bryce Young. But what if they don't go Bryce Young and they go Richardson or Levis? Then that's where you get that fun first-round draft chaos, right? The drops, where does he go? Because after a certain point, you look and it's like, well, then teams don't need quarterbacks. And where do you fall to and stuff, right? So, yeah, you see like the Colts, I think, would be interesting. Seattle, they signed Geno Smith, so probably not. Could the Lions? They could be a dark horse for a quarterback with their pick from the Rams that they have at 6. Raiders, maybe? Like, okay, you got Jimmy G, but can you rely on him? Like, there's so many possibilities. It's so fun.
Yeah. You know, listening to you, you really get fired up about the combine. I mean, you definitely pay attention. Yeah. Why is that?
I do. I call myself a combine junkie, Alyssa. I can't get enough. It's because of what I mentioned. So many people write it off. Oh, they're running fast, and that's not real football stuff. It's not, and, you know, the broad jump or whatever, but you have to piece all this together. So if I'm looking, if I'm looking at, all right, let's say Will Levis again, you know, for quarterback. You could pick your wide receivers. You know, a Bryce Ford Wheaton out of West Virginia, who I absolutely fell in love with. One of my combine crushes, I call him. You see and hear about guys throughout the college, 100, you know. And so it's like, okay, well, if I'm thinking of somebody and I'm watching them at the combine, what that does, I take that information and then I can add that to my scouting from what I watched during their college career or learned, and then do some more investigation. Hey, I liked how this guy cut that skinny post in the combine. All right, well, let me go back. Did he do that in a game? Okay, is it piecing together? Did he improve? So it's all part of the draft conversation. And that's what I really like sinking my teeth into, is why of what these guys are doing, good or bad. You know, maybe someone does something a fluke. I don't think you can do that in the game. And that's okay.
You've highlighted who had some of the best performances, but who improved their draft stock the most? Who was the biggest riser?
Ooh, I think Anthony Richardson. If we go quarterback, I think Richardson, because just people love the, you know, him and probably Will Levis. I think they really rose up. I think, too, a guy out of Princeton, Andre Yoshevis, he was a decathlete, 4.43 second 40-yard dash, 6'3", and 8 inches and 205.
Wow.
From those Ivy League schools, usually, you know, it's like, okay, the competition level isn't there. I thought he had a nice combine. I thought he made nice in strides. He was able to show, and it doesn't mean he's going to be a first-round pick, but I think he could have easily taken himself to a fourth or fifth-round pick up to a third-round pick, maybe even end of the second, depending on how these guys go. So I like him a lot. I think somebody as well that raised their stock was a Marvin Mims Jr. was really good. Shorter guy, but out of the slot, out of OU, he was nice. Matt Landers, I like, 2'6", 200 out of Arkansas. So there's these receivers in what is being widely considered a weaker wide receiver class. There's in this class, you're not getting the last two of like, wow, these are your day one Pro Bowl rookie wide receivers. But you have some darn good pieces that if you don't have to rush these guys and you can put them in as your second or three, still at starters, you can develop some big talent, because there are some big, fast dudes here who can run like they're 5'9", but they're 6'4". And that's what really gets me pumped up from the combine. But it all comes down to two. Here's one other part with the combine. So we see these sizes and stuff from the receivers. I always watch how their hands are in those drills, how you naturally catch the ball. Is it in stride? Do they bobble? Do they fight it? That's another big thing to take away to figure, can a guy bring himself up from a mid-round to a higher-round draft pick potentially?
What is the strongest position in this year's draft?
Ooh, I would say if we're looking at it, I think it might be a little more on the, you know, just to the general public, a little more boring side on the defensive line, I think, is really strong this year. Offensive line is pretty good as well. Linebacker core has some studs. We're going to have some real impact players on the front seven coming in. Drew Sanders out of Arkansas, my goodness. Will Anderson, he's a monster. Nolan Smith as well. And so I think that front seven is really strong. Running backs, you know, I think the running back class is good too. And that's I'm always interested in the running backs each year going into the draft, because sometimes you have years where you either get one taken in the first round or none, and we keep seeing more committees and how much of an investment. But I could argue running back is the position that can be the most effective day one in the NFL. You know, you can just give it, and we see it every year. Guy in, go, and it's like, whoa, and the guy is amazing from day one. So I'm interested to see how the running back situation develops with, as we speak right now, Kareem Hunt and Ezekiel Elliott still not signed.
Yeah. Hey, the calendar is circled for April 27th. We are looking forward to the 2023 NFL Draft. We are winding down our time. We love him. That is Andy McNamara, national fantasy sports host. And just weigh in on some of the notable offseason moves that have taken place. What have we learned?
Boy, well, we've learned the Jets really hope they get Aaron Rodgers. Because imagine this. So the Aaron Rodgers story, I think, is the biggest one still hanging. Because the Jets went out and they got all their guys. But what if the Packers don't technically really, like, they probably want Aaron Rodgers out of their hair, but they don't really need to make a deal. What if they're just like, we wanted this and Jets didn't give it. Then the Jets are stuck with all Aaron Rodgers guys. They already traded Elijah Moore to the Browns, which I think was a tremendous pickup. That's the speed field structure you need. So now, and part of me wants it not to happen just for the fun of the chaos of it. But what if he doesn't go to the Jets? What if? What do you do if you're New York? Do you have to go after Lamar Jackson? Like, is that the next step? Like, where do you go? There's nothing else. And then if he does go, well, then with the Packers, all of a sudden, we're looking at a complete shift in that NFC when it comes to high-end quarterbacks, because Aaron Rodgers will be gone. Jordan Love, the Packers' luck on going back-to-back-to-back quarterbacks, it's run out. You went from Favre to Rodgers, Jordan Love. No, this is a pure step back. That NFC North is going to be wide open with the Bears and the Lions and even the Vikings a little bit. So then you look at it, and really, I think the cream of the crop when we're looking at the NFC, you got to throw in, obviously, the Eagles, the Cowboys, and the 49ers as really the top three that you look at in what's become a, all of a sudden, much weaker true franchise quarterback group in the NFC.
Hey, we're up against the clock. I got to have you weigh in and give me a quick hit on Lamar Jackson. We're just hoping for some magical breakthrough. Where does he end up?
Boy, Alyssa, I got to tell you, I don't know. I don't know.
Wow.
This is the craziest part of it. Because, okay, it came out. It was like, okay, Lamar Jackson at first, he wanted fully guaranteed contract. And by the way, the Browns, getting Deshaun Watson, inadvertently ruined the relationship with their division rival.
Yeah.
With Lamar. Oh, it's just wonderful. I just love it. I'd want it in a big bowl like ice cream and eat it with a spoon every day. I love it. But with Lamar Jackson now, it seems like that relationship is done in Baltimore. By the way, what the heck are the Ravens going to do? You can run out Tyler Huntley? Okay, enjoy that. So now we've bought with Lamar Jackson, who really should reconsider the agent route, man. Like, really should reconsider the agent route. I don't theory it seems cool, but, you know, so now he said, okay, I want a fully guaranteed contract. Now he said, no, I don't want it all guaranteed. I just want more guaranteed than Deshaun Watson. Well, that's a ridiculous statement because Deshaun Watson got $230 million guaranteed dollars. Bro, you're not Joe Burrow. You're not Josh. You're not Pat Mahomes. Okay? You got one MVP. You run around a lot. You put up great fantasy stats, but you have as many playoff wins as Baker Mayfield. And I'll keep saying that. I'll keep pointing that out. You got one, and you keep getting injured more and more each year. So you want that type of money? That's fine. Alyssa, I want a lot of things in life, too. Doesn't mean I'm going to get them.
That's right.
I want a lot. That can mean I'm going to get them. So I don't know. Is he going to actually potentially sit out $32-plus million guaranteed dollars with the Baltimore Ravens if he doesn't play? If he doesn't get the deal? How's that going to work? And I would think at some point that guaranteed money thing has to come down. Or he might not be playing football this year, which would be crazy.
Well, a lot of movement, and we will just have to wait and see. Andy McNamara, National Fantasy Sports host. Give him a follow on Twitter, at AndyMC81. And we look forward to talking to you right around the NFL draft. Thanks, Andy.
Oh, I can't wait. Talk to you soon.
You bet. Stick around. Much more coming your way. Sports Map Radio Network. We will be right back after this quick break.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio Studios, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Elissa Walker-Campbell, welcome back. Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show here in Hour 1. We always love to connect with our audience. We're live on social media at eRadio Sports. You can email the show, info@eradiosports.com, podcastarena.com. Brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save nearly $700 on average. Well, what a performance by UConn on Monday night. They win their fifth national title in program history with that 76-59 win over San Diego State on Monday. So a dominant run by the Huskies, and it's been so much fun to cover all the teams throughout March Madness. A lot of iconic runs in men's basketball, and we're thrilled to have with us Kyle Tucker. He's the college basketball reporter with The Athletic. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, it's good to have you with us on this Saturday afternoon. And so you've had a chance to kind of, you know, think about just how things played out throughout the past month and the championship game on Monday. So what were your takeaways from the Huskies?
Well, I think in general, the takeaways are that college basketball is a whole different animal now in the era of transfers and name, image, and likeness deals and, you know, guys sticking around longer and teams being older and sort of a spreading out of the talent. I think we saw all of that sort of come to fruition in this tournament where you end up with a 5 seed and a 4 seed playing for the national championship, but you also had, you know, San Diego State hadn't even been to a Sweet 16 in its history and is now in, you know, has now played for a national championship. When you think about a Miami that had never been to a Final Four, Florida Atlantic as a 9 seed and a program that had never even won an NCAA tournament game and is playing in the Final Four. No 1 seeds, you know, made it out of the, even into the, I think the Elite Eight, you know, pretty remarkable, tournament in that way. And then specific to UConn, all of that said, when we kind of talked all year about this was a crazy year of college basketball and there was no great team and it was wide open, and while that played out and really in many ways was true, what ended up happening is the team that we thought maybe was the best team early on, then hit a rough patch in the middle of the season, turned out to be the best team after all. I mean, it's easy to forget that UConn started out 14-0, blew out Alabama on a neutral court, blew out Iowa State on a neutral court in November. That was a team that looked like a dominant team, and then they got into Big East play, and it chewed them up and spit them out. They lost 8 conference games, a lot of them kind of clustered all together, and people maybe fell off on UConn, but by the end of the season, and certainly all through that tournament run, they became that team that they looked like early. I think they were the best team early on in the season, and they finished the year with no question that, you know, there was in fact a dominant team, and it was a UConn group that won by an average of 20 points in their 6 NCAA tournament games, one of the top 5 margins of victory ever by a national champion.
You know, opening up our show, Pat Kennedy, legendary men's basketball coach from Florida State, and one of the questions that we talked about was, you know, with UConn, were they the most complete team in men's college basketball?
Oh, I think so. Yeah. I think, you know, one of my colleagues, Sam Vecini, who does a lot of NBA draft breakdown and really studies prospects, and I think is a pretty forward-thinking, you know, modern college basketball mind, posited on social media right after they won that maybe UConn had built sort of the perfect modern basketball team. You know, they had, while they did, you know, build around a big man, Sanogo, and they, you know, they had a great freshman 7-footer as well. They, you know, they had these sort of traditional big men. They also built sort of a modern style around them, and they were so deep and so talented and had so many different guys who could make shots and create their own offense. That they were really impossible to handle. You know, I think you saw the teams that were able to scout them and, you know, we're going to see them twice in league play and were very familiar with them, had a better success with that. But when you got into the NCAA tournament and it was a bunch of teams that hadn't seen those waves of talent coming at you and all the different guys who could hurt you in all the different ways, you know, nobody – teams that were unfamiliar with them and had short amounts of time to prepare for them were not ready for it. And kind of got mowed down by it. So, yeah, I think that's certainly true that this Connecticut team, when it was all said and done, by far looked like the most complete team in the country.
You know, we've had a few days to kind of reflect on how everything has played out. I mean, did you find it refreshing to have new blood and teams that we were not familiar with? Because it makes you want to root for these guys. There were so many intriguing storylines, and everybody loves the Cinderella story.
Yeah, I know. I thought it was certainly refreshing. I do think it's probably overall better. You know, I think doing this once in a while is great for the game. I think in general, from a year-to-year perspective, you probably want some more of the name brand recognition because I think you're going to draw more eyeballs when you do that. I think it's more compelling to the national audience. You know, typically the dream NCAA tournament from a, you know, sort of watchability standpoint is to have some of these exciting upsets early, you know, to have the first couple of rounds be full of sort of the drama and the madness. But you want, you know, you want it to settle out and be, you know, teams and faces and coaches and brand names that people have heard of, or at least some of those. I mean, last year was sort of the dream in that regard for a Final Four. You've got, you know, Duke and Carolina and Coach K's last sort of go round and Kansas and Villanova, the ultimate blue blood Final Four. This was the exact opposite, but it was interesting in another way. I think with UConn ultimately winning it is, you know, the idea of can you create a blue blood out of, you know, out of nothing, out of thin air, a new blue blood in the 21st century, you know, in modern history. And UConn's first national championship was 1999. They've now won 5 titles in 25 years. They've also failed to get out of the first weekend of the NCAA tournament 15 times during that time. So they're very hit or miss. They're either bad or they're the best team in the country at the end of the season. You know, and so there's a conversation there. 5 titles in the last 25 years. In the same 25 years, Duke and North Carolina have won 3 titles. Kansas has won 2 titles. Kentucky's won 1. And UCLA, which has, you know, leads all teams in all-time championships, hasn't won any in the last 25 years. So, you know, is UConn a new blue blood? That's another question that pops up from this tournament.
We've talked about UConn, but as we look ahead, do you anticipate that there will be more widespread parity across the board when we talk about men's basketball?
I do. It's hard not to imagine you know, this continuing because of all the things that I said, you know, from the onset. I think the transfer portal means that, you know, as you stack up talent at some of these traditional powers, if they're not playing right away, if they're not having huge success right away, if they, even if they're playing but they're having a smaller role than they imagine, they don't have to wait. They can go somewhere else and play right away and be that missing piece for somebody. I think the freedom of movement from players, I think the fact that look at Miami, some non-traditional basketball powers, if you happen to have a billionaire benefactor who loves basketball, he can help entice players. You know, it's technically, it's not pay for play, but I think we all know what's really happening. And so it's created this whole new world where I don't think you're going to see, you know, Kentucky, Duke, Kansas just hoard all the talent and, you know, run roughshod over everybody else. That's just not going to happen, I don't think, very often anymore. I think there's been redistribution of wealth, you know, in college basketball. And so I think it's changed the landscape probably forever. Certainly unless, you know, these things go cyclically, unless, you know, the powers that be buck against that idea and change it all back at some point. But right now, with the current rules, I think we're going to see a lot of parity going forward.
Well, and one can only wonder what the 2023-24 season holds for us. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch. But one of the things I want to talk to you about is, what's your perception of the Big East Conference? It's got to be, I mean, one of the premier conferences, obviously, in the country.
It certainly has an argument right now to be the best conference in the country. I mean, again, just look at the fact that I think UConn ultimately went 17-0 in the non-conference and won those games by 400 and something points. Smashed everybody. That was, you know, all six NCAA tournament games obviously were non-conference games. Smashed everybody in that. And then the fact that that league found a way to beat UConn eight times. When you've got Villanova and Creighton and Providence and Xavier and Marquette, you know, that's a pretty remarkable, remarkable league. And it's a lot to overcome.
Hey, we are wrapping up our time. College basketball reporter with The Athletic, that is Kyle Tucker. And Kyle, direct our audience, our listeners, where can they go and check out your work online?
Yeah, I'm at KyleTucker_ATH on Twitter and also at theathletic.com and on the Athletic app, and come check it out.
Hey, UConn crown champions on Monday night. My last question for you is, can they go back-to-back? Make that dominant run continue?
I mean, you would think not. Nobody's done it since the 90s. It's been, Florida did it in 06, 07. So it can be done. It hasn't been done in a good while. It's only been done a handful of times since UCLA was a dynasty. So my initial gut reaction is no. But again, in the transfer portal era, they could lose some key guys and just go right back and add some more. And I think they're a very attractive destination now, given what Danny Hurley was just able to do. And, you know, some of those pieces were transfer pieces that really thrived. And, you know, Tristan Newton was a star for them. And he was at East Carolina a year ago.
Yeah, it's going to be fascinating to watch. So glad he's been with us. That is Kyle Tucker. Check him out with The Athletic, college basketball reporter. We look forward to catching up with you in the fall. Thanks, Kyle.
Thanks so much.
You bet. Stick around. Much more coming your way at Sports Map Radio Network.
You're listening to the Big E Sports Show on the Sports Map Radio Network. From the Sports Map Radio studios, here's Elissa Walker-Campbell.
Hey, Elissa Walker-Campbell. Welcome back. Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show, sponsored by Progressive Insurance. Are you looking for a career where you will love flexibility, great pay, and benefits at one of the country's top workplaces? Come join the growing team. Go to progressive.com/careers and apply online today. Our March Madness coverage continues, but right now we're going to do a crossover and shift gears. We're going to go around the horn and talk some MLB and preview the 2023 Houston Astros. And we can't forget, we got a long memory. The Astros won the World Series 4-2 over the Phillies before a capacity home crowd right here in Houston at Minute Maid Park. And we are so thrilled to have back with us to break it all down. And that is Astros beat writer and his 19th season, Brian McTaggart. How you doing, Brian?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Alyssa?
Hey, it's good to have you on the program. And last time we had you on the show, we were celebrating the historic run for the Astros and just another world championship. So what's been the focus right now in the offseason? Just kind of get us up to speed on some of those offseason headlines and the movement that took place.
Well, I mean, the two biggest things that happened were they lost Justin Verlander to the Mets in free agency, and they signed Jose Abreu, the first baseman from the White Sox, who was the AL MVP just a couple of years ago. They signed him to replace Yuli Gurriel. So, they really didn't have to do a whole lot, of course, coming off a World Series championship. They had most of their players back. So, you know, losing Verlander hurts, but they have enough pitching depth, they felt, to where they could absorb that. And they do, as long as everybody's healthy, and then their lineup got better with Abreu. So if you looked around baseball this offseason, teams were spending hundreds of millions of dollars to try to improve their roster to do what the Astros just did, and that was win the World Series. And the Astros only had to make a couple little moves, although Abreu move was a big one, just to sort of get back to being the favorite, and they are the favorite again if they can stay healthy.
You know, Brian, you talk about some of the movement and how much they will miss perhaps Justin Verlander, but I think one of the biggest spring storylines is a second baseman, Jose Altuve, needed surgery to repair a broken right thumb after being hit by a pitch. So how's he doing, and how many weeks will he be out, and when will he return?
Yeah, that was a big loss. He was playing in the World Baseball Classic, got hit by a pitch on, I believe it was March 19th, so he had surgery a few days later. He's going to be out a couple of months, so I wouldn't expect him in an Astros game, I think, before June 1st, because he's going to have, he's going to have a long rehab, and he's going to have to play in some minor league games. So it's going to be a process, but that's a huge blow, not just because, what he provides, defensively. He's their leadoff hitter. He's their leader. He's, the longest tenured player on this team. He's right now one of the top two or three greatest players in franchise history, and he had a great year last year. So losing him, for a first couple of months of the season really weakens their lineup. It makes them a little bit more vulnerable. So they're going to have to turn to David Hensley or Mauricio Dubon to try to replace that. They're not Jose Altuve. They're not going to duplicate his numbers. So it's going to be tough, I think, for the Astros as long as Altuve is out. But the good news is he's on the path to recovery. It's just going to be an 8-week recovery, it looks like.
Astros beat reporter Brian McTaggart with us at Sports Map Radio Network. Give him a follow on Twitter, at Brian McTaggart. And you're down there in Florida. So what are some of your observations? What have you seen from the Astros spring training? And who's been a standout?
Yeah, well, it's been weird because they had so many players play in the World Baseball Classic that it's most of their key players weren't here. I mean, Jose Abreu was here the whole time, the newcomer. What stood out to me about him was this guy, for all he's accomplished in his career, works extremely hard. He worked extremely hard at first base, trying to get better at first base. And he looks like he's going to be what he was advertised to be, somebody who can take the ball every day and start at first base, a guy who can drive in a lot of runs. So he's been impressive. Their starting pitching has been impressive. Framber Valdez, who's going to start on opening day Thursday at Minute Maid, has had a very nice spring. The Astros kind of urged him not to go to the WBC. They wanted him here. And after, there's been some injuries at the WBC, that was probably a good idea. They did have an injury early in camp. Lance McCullers Jr. hasn't thrown. So that's got to be a concern as well. The guy that's opened eyes in camp is probably a guy not a lot of listeners have heard of. It's an outfielder named Justin Bearden. He was undrafted in 2020, and he's just come in here and hit and hit and hit. And now he's put himself on the map for a chance to make this team, especially when you consider Michael Brantley is going to be on the injured list to start the year as he recovers from shoulder surgery. So that's just a couple of the names to keep an eye on. Alex Bregman's been here the whole time, and he's been Alex Bregman, so not worried about him. But it's been a long spring, but they're almost to the end.
You know, Brian, you've been covering the Astros, for over 20 years. Does spring training, does that translate to regular season success?
No, not at all, because the Astros have not had their starting lineup. They're in the same lineup for any game this spring. I mean, the way it usually works is they'll start three or four of their main position players, and then it's prospects. And also, even if they did start all of their eight or nine position players, by the fifth or sixth inning, prospects come in. So win-loss records don't mean anything. Pitchers are working on pitches. You know, batters are working on this. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what the Astros' record is in the spring. It really doesn't matter. I don't know what their record was in the spring last year, because when Thursday night comes around, opening day, and they have their A lineup out there, and they have Framber Valdez on the mound, the goal is to win the game. That's not really the goal down here at spring training.
What is the most pressing question for the Astros? What issues that might be lingering? I mean, it sounds like they're loaded from top to bottom, but where may they might be vulnerable?
Well, I think their number one issue going into the season is health. I mean, if this team is healthy, it's the best team in the major leagues. They have health issues right now. We talked about Altuve. McCullers is going to be out. Michael Brantley is going to be out at least at the start of the season. Yordan Alvarez has had this hand issue. He didn't get in the spring training game until Thursday. And Hunter Brown, their top pitching prospect, who they were counting on being in the rotation, had to be scratched from his last start down here because of a tight back. So Astros were really, really healthy last year, and that was one of the keys to their success. One of the reasons why, you know, they got to the playoffs and they were able to rest their players, because they didn't have many guys on the IL. And then when they hit the playoffs, their players were, and their pitchers especially, were pretty fresh. So they're already battling some injuries, and I think it's going to really test their depth. And I wouldn't be surprised if they try to make a move maybe before opening day to bring in a body or two to help them. But they need to try to get healthy by the time Altuve comes back, and then put themselves in a position to win the division again.
You were listening to The Voice, Brian McTaggart, Astros beat reporter at Sports Map Radio Network, the Big E Sports Show. We've talked and highlighted several of the players, but we got to shine the spotlight on the manager, and that is Dusty Baker. He re-upped for another season immediately after the Astros beat Philly. So I'm just wondering, I mean, he's 73 years young. How does he find the energy, and what's the key to his success and longevity?
Yeah, he's amazing. He's an amazing man. Yeah, 73, and he's out here every day, and he loves every minute of it. I mean, I think there's a couple of things driving him. I mean, when he went into last year, there were two main things driving him. He wanted to get 2,000 wins, which he did. He wanted to win a World Series because he'd never won one as a manager, which he did. So what's driving him now? He really wants to win a second World Series and match Cito Gaston, who is a mentor of his. Cito won two World Series with the Blue Jays. He's the only black manager to win two World Series. Dusty wants to join him in that company. And also, Dusty is rooming down here with his son. His son is a player and
he is
a good prospect for the Washington Nationals.
Uh-huh.
And the Nationals and Astros share a spring training facility. So every night, Dusty goes home and he hangs out with his son. And that is something that I think is a pretty magical, you know, phase in his life right now. And as long as his son's on the Nationals, as long as he can manage, he wants to keep that going forever. So his son, he said over and over, his son keeps him young, and he is definitely the hippest 73-year-old that I know.
So, Brian, when you evaluate him, what is his strength? Because you think about his longevity, all the years that he has been, you know, coaching, it's such an inspiring journey. But his ability to connect and adapt to younger players, I mean, the game has changed.
Yeah, the game's changed, and but kind of what I said a little bit before, too, like, Dusty, he's young at heart. I mean, he's not – you talk to him, and he can talk about modern music. He can talk about culture right now, but he can also give you a million stories of years gone by and give you life lessons that will blow you away. So he's able to touch a lot of different people and communicate. He's able to make everybody feel comfortable. He's so well respected in the game by everybody that I think players want to play for him. I think they want to win for him. And it worked out last year. He finally got that first World Series championship. But I've never really come across a player who played for Dusty who didn't like or respect him.
The Houston Astros winning their second World Series title in 6 years, and we are so thrilled that he has been with us, and that is Brian McTaggart. Give him a follow on Twitter, at Brian McTaggart. Also, where can they go to find out everything that you're providing on the Astros? Where do they need to go?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. If not, go to Astros.com. Every day we have all the latest news on the Astros, and it's all free. There's no passwords. There's no paywalls, nothing to sign up. You just click on it and read, and we have videos, and that's your go-to source for all the Astros news.
Okay, good stuff. We're looking forward to opening day. Thank you, Brian.
All right.